This is lecture 14 of Rudolf Steiner's lecture cycle, The Foundations of Human Experience. This is the synopsis. The three aspects of the physical body. The three aspects of the head. The head, the chest, the nose as metamorphosed lung, and the limbs, jaws. The limbs as metamorphosed jaw. The chest torso between the head and the limbs. The tendency of the upper chest aspect toward the head aspect, larynx and speech, and the lower chest aspect toward a coarsened limb formation, sexuality. Appealing to imagination through teaching material in the last elementary school years. Example of the Pythagorean theorem. The conditions of the teacher. Permeate the teaching material with feeling will and maintain a lively imagination. Pedantry is immoral. 19th-century views concerning the use of imagination in teaching. Schelling. The teacher's motto. Imagination, sense of truth, feeling of responsibility. End of synopsis. Lecture 14 given in Stuttgart, September 5th, 1919. If, in the interest of developing a true pedagogical art, we consider people as we have until now, then, because of many different things, the threefold aspect of the human physical body becomes apparent. We clearly differentiate between everything connected with the form of the human head and everything to do with the form of the chest, and in general the torso, and with the form of the limbs. We need to understand that the limbs are much more complicated than people normally think, because what the limbs represent extends from outside into the human being. We need to differentiate between the forms from within outward in human beings and those inserted into the human body from outside. If we consider these three parts of the human body, it becomes particularly clear that the human head is a whole human being raised above the animal world. In the head, we have the actual head, and we also have the torso, that is everything associated with the nose. And we have a limb component that extends into the cavity of the body, that is, everything surrounding the mouth. In this way, we can see how the entire physical human being is present in the head. But only the head's chest is stunted. It is stunted to the degree that we can only vaguely recognize the connection between the nose and lungs. Nevertheless, the nose is related to the lungs. The human nose, to a certain extent, is a metamorphosed lung. The nose transforms the breathing process so that it is directed toward the physical. It would be a mistake to view the lung as less spiritual than the nose. The lung is more artistically formed. The spirit, or at least the soul, permeates it more completely than the nose. If you understand things properly, you will see that although the nose sits shamelessly in the middle of the human face, the lungs, even though they are more closely connected with the soul, modestly hide their existence. Everything about the human mouth, with its undeniable relationship to nutrition and the human limbs, is connected with metabolism, digestion, and nutrition, and extends the limb forces into the human being. Thus the human head is a complete human being. Only the things not head-like in it are stunted. The chest and abdomen exist in the head, but there they are stunted. By contrast, when we look at the limb aspect of the human being, everything that the limbs represent in their external form and development is primarily a transformation of the upper and lower jaws. Stunted forms of what your legs and feet, arms and hands are enclose your mouth from above and below. You only have to think of them in the proper way. Now you might interject that when you imagine your arms and hands to be the upper jaw and your legs and feet the lower jaw, the question arises about the purpose of what this jaw represents. Where does it bite? Where is the mouth? It is at the points where your upper arm and your upper leg or thigh bone join your body. If you imagine that this is the human torso, Rudolf Steiner begins to draw, then you must imagine that somewhere out there is the actual head. The mouth opens on the upper side and the lower side, so that you can imagine a curious tendency for the jaws of an invisible head to open toward your chest and stomach. What does this invisible head do? It continuously consumes you and spreads its quote-unquote mouth open toward you. In this form, you have a wonderful picture of what actually exists. While the real human head is a physical material head, the head associated with the limbs is a spiritual head. However, it becomes a little material in order to continuously consume the human being. When human beings die, this spiritual head has completely consumed them. It is an amazing fact that our limbs are formed so that they can continuously consume us. Let me read that again. It is an amazing fact that our limbs are formed so that they can continuously consume us. Our organism is always slipping into the wide open mouth of our spirituality. The spirit demands of us a continuous sacrifice of devotion, and this sacrifice expresses itself in the form of our bodies. We cannot understand the human form if we cannot see how this sacrifice, devoted to the spirit, is expressed in the relationship between the human limbs and the rest of the human body. The head and the limb natures of the human being exist at extremes, and the chest or torso nature is in the middle, and in a sense it creates the balance between these two extremes. The human chest is head and limb nature as well. The limb and head aspects mix into the nature of the chest. The chest at its upper end always has a tendency to become head, and at the lower end the tendency to adjust itself to the stretched out limbs, to the external world. In other words, the lower end of the torso tends to take on the nature of the limbs. The upper portion of the chest tends to become head, and the lower portion tends to become limbs. Although the upper portion of the human torso always wants to become head, it cannot do so. The other head inhibits this, and the chest can only bring forth a likeness of the head, something we might call the beginning of a head. Can we clearly recognize that the upper part of the chest makes a start toward the formation of a head? Yes, the larynx, which people intuitively call the quote-unquote throat head, is there. The German Kehlkopf, or for larynx. Larynx is literally throat head. The human larynx is, without a doubt, a stunted human head, a quote-unquote head that cannot quite become head and therefore can only live out its head nature through human speech. Human speech is a continual attempt to become a head in the air. When the larynx attempts to become uppermost in the head, it produces the sounds that human nature holds back most strongly. When the larynx attempts to take on the characteristics of the nose, it cannot truly become a nose, because the real nose hinders it. It thus brings forth nasal sounds when it attempts to become a nose. In nasal sounds, the actual nose constricts the arising air nose. It is particularly significant that human speech continually attempts to create parts of the head in the air, and that these parts of the head expand in wave-like movements, so that the physical head then constricts. This is human speech. It will certainly not amaze you that the moment the head is physically complete, around the age of 7, the change of teeth presents the opportunity for the soul head to arise from the larynx, permeated with a kind of skeleton. However, it must be a quote-unquote soul skeleton. We do this by ending the wild development of language by imitation, and instead begin to control speech development through grammar. We must be aware that when we receive children in elementary school, we need to practice an activity on the soul similar to what is practiced by the body when it produces the second set of teeth. We make the development of speech firm in the soul aspect when we include grammar in a reasonable way, so that what comes from speech enters into writing and reading. We will achieve a proper relationship of feeling to human speech if we know that the words people form tend to become the head. In the same way that the human chest has an upward tendency to become the head, it also has a downward tendency to become the limbs. Just as speech arises from the larynx as a refined head, a head caught in the air, everything that continues downward from the human chest toward the limbs has a coarsened limb nature. In a sense, what the world pushes into people has a thickened and coarsened limb nature. When science begins finally to explore the secret of how the hands and feet, arms and legs are coarsened and inserted more deeply into people than they appear, it will have discovered the answer to the riddle of sexuality. Only then will people find the proper tone to speak of such things. It is not surprising that all of the discussion we hear today about how we should handle sex education really has no meaning. People cannot explain what they do not understand. Modern science has absolutely no understanding of what we have only hinted at about the connection between the human limbs and torso. However, you must know that just as we insert what entered the nature of the teeth before age 7 into the soul, in the first years of elementary school, so we must in the final years of elementary school bring into the child's soul life what comes from the nature of the limbs and is first fully expressed at puberty. Thus, just as the soul teeth appear as a capacity to learn to read and write, an activity of imagination and a permeation of inner warmth announces what the soul develops toward the end of elementary school at the age of 12 to 15 years. You must emphasize particularly anything that deepens on the soul's capacity to fill things with inner love, that is, everything expressed by imagination. You must appeal to the power of imagination, particularly in the final years of elementary school. We are more justified in requiring the 7-year-old child to develop intellectuality through reading and writing than we are in neglecting to bring imagination continually into the power of judgment that slowly approaches at the age of 12. We must teach everything children have to learn in those years by stimulating their imagination. That is how we must teach everything concerning history and geography. We also appeal to children's imagination when, for instance, we tell them, quote, "Here you see a lens that collects light. You have such a lens in your eye." EYE. "You are familiar with the camera that makes images of things. Your eye, EYE, is such a camera." Unquote. Here, too, when we show how human sense organs embody things that exist in the world, we are actually appealing to the child's imagination. What they embody is visible only as a corpse when we remove it from the body. We cannot see it in the living body. In the same way, all the instruction given for geometry and even for arithmetic must not fail to appeal to imagination. We appeal to imagination if we always make an effort to have the children use their imagination, even in geometry and arithmetic. We attempted this in the practical part of this seminar, when considering how to make surfaces comprehensible not only to the child's intellect, in such a way that the child would truly comprehend the nature of a surface. As I said yesterday, I'm surprised that no one ever thought of explaining the Pythagorean theorem in the following way. Suppose there were 3 children. One child blows enough powder onto a square to cover it. The second child does the same with a second square, the third with a small square. We can encourage the children's imagination by showing them that the amount of powder that covers the large area equals the combined amounts of powder on the small and middle-sized surfaces. Then we would draw the children's comprehension into the powder blown onto the squares, not through mathematical exactness, but with imagination. The children would follow the surface in their imagination. They would understand the Pythagorean theorem through their imagination and through the flying powder blown onto a square. We cannot, of course, perform this in reality, but we can engage the children's imagination. In these years, we must always take care that, as teachers, we create what goes from us to the children in an exciting way, so that it gives rise to imagination. Teachers must inwardly and livingly preserve the subject material. They must fill it with imagination. This is not possible unless we fill it with feeling will. In later years, this often has a strange effect. What we must emphasize, and what is particularly important toward the end of elementary school, is community life, the harmonious life between teacher and children. No one can become a good grade school teacher who does not always try to present the lesson with imagination and in a fresh way. It is a fact that when we present things one time filled with imagination and continue to repeat them, they become frozen in the intellect. We must continually keep imagination alive, otherwise what it produces becomes petrified. This, however, sheds some light on how teachers themselves must be. They must never, at any time in their lives, be bitter. There are two concepts that never fit together if life is to be fertile: pedantry and the vocation of teaching. If teaching and pedantry come together in life, the result will be an extremely unhealthy marriage, more so than anything else life could offer. I do not believe we need accept the absurdity that there has ever been a union of pedantry and the vocation of teaching. You can see, therefore, that teaching has a certain inner morality, an inner responsibility. Teachers truly have a categorical imperative. This categorical imperative is, keep your imagination alive. If you feel yourself becoming pedantic, then say to yourself, for other people, pedantry may be bad, but for me, it is immoral. This must be the teacher's attitude. If it is not the teacher's attitude, then teachers must consider learning how to use their knowledge of teaching for another profession. Of course, in life we cannot accomplish these things and achieve completely the ideal. However, we must at least know the ideal. You will not have the proper enthusiasm for pedagogical morality if you do not fill yourself with something fundamental. That is the recognition that the head itself is already a complete human being with stunted limbs and chest. You must know that each limb of a human being is a complete human being, but with the head and chest stunted. That and in the chest, the head and limbs maintain balance. If you use this fundamental thought, then you will receive inner strength from it, so that you can fill your pedagogical morality with the necessary enthusiasm. What forms human intellectuality has a strong tendency to become slow and lazy, and it becomes most lazy when people constantly feed it with materialistic ideas. However, it will take flight when we feed it ideas received from the Spirit. But we receive these into our souls only through the indirect path of imagination. How people ranted and raved against including imagination in education during the late 19th century. In the first half of the 19th century, we had such brilliant people as Schelling, for example, who thought more soundly about education. You should read Schelling's exciting discussions in Concerning the Method of Academic Study, which was, of course, not intended for elementary school, but the early 19th century spirit of pedagogy lives in it. During the second half of the 19th century, people understood this spirit in a masked form. Then people were cowardly about the life of the soul and complained about whatever entered the human soul through the indirect path of imagination, because they believed that if they accepted imagination, they would fall directly into the arms of untruthfulness. People did not have the courage for independence, for freedom in their thinking, and at the same time for a marriage to truth instead of lies. People feared freedom in thinking because they believed they would immediately take lies into the soul. To what I just said, that is, to filling their lessons with imagination, teachers must therefore add courage for the truth. Without this courage for truth, teachers will achieve nothing with the will in teaching, especially with the older children. We must join what develops as courage for truth with the strong sense of responsibility toward truth. A need for imagination, a sense for truth, and a feeling for responsibility. These are the three forces that constitute the nerves of pedagogy. Those who would take up education should write this as their motto: enliven imagination, stand for truth, feel responsibility. The end of lecture 14. That's the end of the normal cycle of lectures. There will be eventually two additional lectures added onto this cycle, but this is the official end of this.